We're going to listen to our breath and discover what a meditation practice can do for our lives on this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A pair of researchers did the rigorous scientific testing on thousands of studies on meditation. They found that meditation can help us be more compassionate and decrease symptoms of depression and anxiety. Richard Davidson is the William James and Vilas Research Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry at UW-Madison, where he directs a brain lab and founded the Center for Healthy Minds. He's co-author of the new book, Altered Traits: Science Reveals How Meditation Changes Your Mind, Brain, and Body. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, more and more we're seeing headlines in the news about the benefits and rising popularity of meditation. Can you help us get a working definition first? What is meditation?
Sure. Meditation is the intentional inspection and recognition of the workings of our own mind. And through that, we can better regulate our attention, better regulate our emotions, and in general, produce more balance in our lives. And so meditation involves different techniques to come to be more familiar with our mind, and through that, to better regulate our mind.
And so when we say we're going to meditate, what might we be doing? Will we be sitting quietly and not trying to think or trying to get thoughts out of our mind? Is that meditation?
Not exactly. So meditation, first of all, can be lots of different things. You can think of meditation in a way that's similar to the word sports. There are many, many different kinds of sports. Similarly, there are many different kinds of meditation. The thing that is shared among the different kinds of meditation is becoming more familiar with your own mind and learning to regulate your own mind. When we're meditating, though, we're not really trying to fix anything. We're not trying to change anything. The key attribute is awareness, becoming more aware of what is going on in our mind. That really is an essential foundation of virtually all forms of meditation. There is so much external attention in our culture. We're so pulled by things around us, by information coming in constantly, that we actually spend so little time inspecting, getting to know, becoming more familiar with our own mind. And the invitation in all of this is that becoming more familiar with our mind allows us to better regulate our minds in ways which can be beneficial.
Well, let's explore the history of meditation. As it's mentioned in your book, Altered Traits, in the last 20 years or so, meditation has gone from being something your cooler or slightly eccentric friends might practice to fix problems of all sorts, from weight issues to relationship difficulty or productivity issues. When meditation was created, what was it designed to do or intended for?
That's a great question. And, of course, meditation has been around for 2,500 years. So it's been around quite a long time, way before any of the scientific research. And it was not designed to cure any illness or to fix any problem. It was really designed to improve well-being, to produce awakening, and to relieve the pervasive kind of ill ease or suffering that is ubiquitous in a human being. So that's really what meditation was originally designed for.
When we think of the early days of meditation, often think of Buddhist monks practicing meditation. Is that true? Is that where you would see most of the meditation early on?
Well, certainly the Buddhist tradition is a rich source of the practices that have been brought to the West. Of course, many of those practices have been turned into a secular form, and mostly what's been studied are the secular forms of those practices, which may have originally found their roots in certain Asian traditions like Buddhism. It turns out that most Buddhist monks actually don't meditate. That's a myth. Only a small fraction of them meditate. The ones who do meditate are ones that have been, some of them have been studied scientifically, but just as in many other religious traditions, the serious practitioners are relatively rare, and it's not something that every Buddhist monk does.
Talking right now with Richard Davidson. He is the William James and Vilas Research Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry, directs a brain lab, and founded the Center for Healthy Minds at UW-Madison. His new book he co-wrote is Altered Traits: Science Reveals How Meditation Changes Your Mind, Brain, and Body. Richard, how has meditation been secularized?
It's been secularized by removing the religious context in which it was originally embedded, basically rendered into a form that you can think of as mental exercise. So just as we commonly practice physical exercise, this is a form you can think of as mental exercise designed to strengthen certain functions of the mind, functions such as the ability to focus attention, or the ability to regulate our emotions. And when it's presented in this way, I think most people in the West can quite easily and intuitively grasp its potential value and why it may be important. And just to give one example, there's scientific research that shows very clearly that the average American adult spends approximately 47% of her or his waking life actually not paying attention to what they're doing, that is, being distracted. And that is an unfortunate statistic, but that's an area where I strongly believe, based upon the scientific research, that secular versions of meditation can make a difference. We can all learn to pay attention better than we do. It is a trainable skill. And so this is where meditation, I think, can be so useful for the modern world.
So you're saying about half of our time we're not focused on the present, we're not focused on what we're doing at hand?
Yes, based upon hard-nosed scientific research. This is actually a study that was done by a group of psychologists at Harvard a few years ago.
So what is the difference between meditation and mindfulness? Mindfulness, another word we often hear a lot associated with meditation.
Yes, so that's another great question. Mindfulness is really a quality of the mind, and it can be cultivated or learned. It's often used to refer to a particular style of meditation. There are specific kinds of meditation practices that are said to be mindfulness meditation practices, which can potentially help a person to cultivate that quality of mindfulness, which is a quality of remembering to be present, remembering to bring our focus to the present moment.
How does yoga play into that, play into mindfulness?
Yoga, first of all, just as there are many different forms of meditation, there are many different forms of yoga. The word yoga in the West most frequently means hatha yoga, which is a physical practice, but not all yoga is physical practice. The there's certainly some relation between them, and many people find that doing hatha yoga, particularly doing it in a way that also cultivates mindfulness of the body, can be a very helpful entry point to certain kinds of meditation.
One of the takeaways from the research on meditation is that even a few minutes a day of meditation can really make a difference to our mental state, particularly when we make a habit of it. UW-Madison brain scientist Richard Davidson stays with us. He's co-author of the new book, Altered Traits: Science Reveals How Meditation Changes Your Mind, Brain, and Body. We'll have more of this conversation after a check of the latest news. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We're exploring the benefits of meditation and the conclusions drawn from scientific research on meditation during this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent with you on the Ideas Network. When you scan the brains of dozens of Tibetan monks who have meditated for thousands or tens of thousands of hours, what do those brains tell us? We're getting analysis from UW-Madison neuroscientist Richard Davidson. He stays with us. His new book is Altered Traits: Science Reveals How Meditation Changes Your Mind, Brain, and Body. Your insights and questions on meditation are welcome as well. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Richard, what did the brains of Tibetan monks tell you about meditation?
We first began our work by studying the brains of Tibetan practitioners who have spent years training their mind. The average lifetime practice of these individuals was about 34,000 hours. That's a lot of time. And we reasoned that we needed to start there because if we didn't see anything on our measurements with these individuals, it would be very unlikely that we would see something in less practiced individuals, in more novice meditators. And so that's where we began. And what we discovered is that their brains are really quite different. And we can see in certain cases some very dramatic differences. So one of the first ways in which we applied modern neuroscientific measurements is by studying their brain electrical signals, where we place an array of sensors on the head. Many sensors, more than 200 sensors, go on the head to monitor the brain electrical signals, both in a baseline state as well as when they're meditating. And what we found is the presence of what we call in neuroscience high amplitude gamma oscillations. These gamma oscillations are very fast frequency brain rhythms, and they are associated with certain kinds of brain plasticity. And they are also associated with certain kinds of focused attention, and also with insight. That is, we've all had moments when we have a kind of aha experience. Well, they seem to be having aha experiences quite continuously, where their mind is bringing elements together that may not have been brought together commonly before. So there's a lot of interconnectivity going on, which we could see in these gamma oscillations. And then when they meditate, these gamma oscillations get even stronger. So that's one observation. And we think that this is importantly related to their ability to focus attention, regulate their attention in a way which is vastly more skilled than the average person off the street. A second way in which their brains are different is that when they meditate on compassion, and this is a different kind of meditation, where instead of simply focusing their awareness on their breath or their body, they cultivate explicitly the aspiration to relieve the suffering of others. And so this is a kind of practice that's very commonly done in certain Asian traditions. And it often involves invoking a specific person or a group of people and reflecting on how they may be suffering, and then cultivating the strong aspiration that they be relieved from that suffering, and taking the perspective of others, feeling the emotions of others, and then generating this strong aspiration to relieve suffering. And this is said to prepare the individual for the real world, so that whenever a person they encounter might be ill at ease or suffering, they spring into action and they can do something to help relieve that suffering. And what we see activated in the brain is a set of networks that are networks that we think are important for compassion. They overlap with networks involved in empathy, but they're also different. And they're different in some very important ways. This again suggests to us that when they engage in these practices, they are literally reshaping their brain, rewiring their brain in ways that support these enduring changes. And this really goes back to the title of our book, Altered Traits. What traits mean are enduring characteristics. And what these meditation practices are fundamentally about is changing the mind in a way which is enduring, so that it affects every nook and cranny of our everyday life, rather than simply producing some experience when we're meditating. The real benefit of meditation is when we're off the cushion, so to speak, and in the real world.
And Richard, many of us here in the West, we are the average person off the street when it comes to meditation. How do we go about starting a meditation practice?
Yeah, that's a great question. And my advice to people is to start extremely modestly. And it's really how any new habit is formed, not to take on something unrealistic. So we can make a New Year's resolution to meditate 45 minutes a day, but that usually dissipates very, very quickly. And so my advice is to really start with extremely small chunks of time. So we often will ask a person, what's the minimum amount of time that you think you can meditate every single day for 30 days in a row without a lapse? And even if that is 1 minute a day, that's okay. Whatever that amount is, but make a commitment for the smallest amount of time that you can meditate every day, and do that for 30 days. And that's how a habit begins.
And so now we've made that commitment. We've set aside an amount of time we think, or we perhaps are very confident that we can commit to each day. Where should we go for this meditation? How should we have our environment?
Yeah, so one of the things that we're blessed with here in the West is a plethora of opportunities to learn to meditate. There's so many different resources available on the internet and in many communities throughout our country. I often tell people that the best form of meditation that they could do is the form of meditation that they do. Finding something that sits well, that a person resonates with, is so important. And unfortunately, that can sometimes take a little bit of time through trial and error. A person needs to find some kind of practice that resonates with them. There's just a huge amount of of opportunity available now in the West. And in virtually every academic medical center in the United States, mindfulness-based stress reduction is taught. This is a form of secular mindfulness meditation that was developed by Jon Kabat-Zinn of the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. And this is quite a standardized course. It's an 8-week course, and it's been studied intensively scientifically, and there's very good evidence to suggest that it could be of some benefit. And that's often a very good place for a person to start. It's a structured program, one class a week for 8 weeks, and that's widely available.
Richard Davidson stays with us. The new book is Altered Traits: Science Reveals How Meditation Changes Your Mind, Brain, and Body. You can join in this conversation about meditation at 800-642-1234. Do you think that there's a better use of your time than to sit quietly and listen to your breath? Are you reluctant to make meditation a priority? What's your impression of meditation? What's holding you back? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Richard, some elementary schools practice mindfulness every morning during the morning announcement. There's a couple minutes of meditation. Do you see schools using mindfulness training, and what are they reporting back about it?
We do see that, and in fact, we ourselves have conducted serious scientific research in public schools where we have been investigating the impact of these kinds of programs. And what we see is benefit. We see improvements in children's ability to regulate their attention and regulate their emotions. What parent does not want their son or daughter to better learn to pay attention and to better learn to regulate their emotions? And, you know, when we reflect on it, the scientific evidence suggests very, very clearly that a child's capacity to exert this kind of self-control is a better predictor of major life outcomes when they're in their 30s than IQ, grade point average, and standardized test scores all put together once you're above a certain minimum level. And so it is really penny wise and pound foolish for us as a society not to make a major investment in this area. One of the metrics that's used in scientific research to look at young adult life outcomes is financial success. Kids who are better able to regulate themselves, who have better self-regulation early in life, actually end up earning more money and being more financially successful and having fewer health problems, less drug abuse, all of which save taxpayers money. And so even strictly from an economic perspective, it makes sense. And attention is the building block for every other form of learning. And it's remarkable, and I would say even unconscionable, that we as a culture don't pay enough attention to educating our children in these very basic skills that underlie everything else that they do in life.
Well, Eric in Appleton sent an email asking, I'd love to teach my 8-year-old to be more mindful. How could we begin a meditation practice together? Eric says, I don't currently meditate myself, but have been interested in trying.
Well, there are, again, lots of resources available. I would encourage Eric to go on our center website, which is the Center for Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The website is centerhealthyminds.org. There are resources available there. We've developed a mindfulness-based kindness curriculum for young children, and we have it available free. You can sign up to receive it on our website, and there are specific guided practices that young children can learn.
How do we know that we're doing the meditation correctly? People say, follow this meditation practice, but how do, I know there's so much in the West trying to make sure you do it absolutely correctly. How do you know if you're doing meditation the right way?
Yeah, that's a very important question too. And this is why it's really for exactly the reason that you're suggesting in your question, that if possible, it would be very valuable, I think, to initially learn under the guidance of some more experienced person, of some teacher, if possible, to have the teacher be able to direct you in a way that increases the likelihood that you are doing the practice so-called correctly. It's actually quite easy to learn, but we need to be reminded of it. And having someone who has more experience can often be very helpful. So I think that if possible, doing it, learning in that way would be helpful. But if it's not possible, there are many guided practices that are available on the internet from very reputable teachers. And if you stick to the guidance, I think that in many cases that can also be an effective way to learn.
What would you tell the person who says, my mind doesn't stop, it doesn't slow down, it's always on the go, and why should it be any other way? Why should I train my mind to do something else?
Well, it's a very, very critical question. And first of all, whoever might ask that question is not alone, because the vast majority of people have minds that are similar. Our minds, human minds, do that. Human minds are active. Human minds generate lots of thought. And so the goal of meditation is not to change that. It's not to pacify that. The goal of meditation is to become aware of that. And usually we're actually not aware of it. Usually we're so focused on things outside of ourselves in our external environment that we pay very little attention to what's going on inside. And the beginning of the practice is really to gain awareness of what's going on in our mind. And it's through awareness gradually over time that our thoughts and our feelings don't necessarily change, but we change our relationship to them so that they no longer hijack us. They no longer grab us in the same way. So it's not that we necessarily, we don't stop thinking, we don't change our thoughts, we don't change our emotions, but what we do is we alter our relationship to them, and that's critically important.
Committing to a meditation practice can yield a measurable positive impact to our mind and body. Turns out meditation is really good for the brain. That is the upshot of the new book, Altered Traits. Co-author Richard Davidson is with us. He is a professor of psychology and psychiatry. He directs a brain lab, and he founded the Center for Healthy Minds at UW-Madison. You can join the conversation about meditation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a meditation practice? How has it impacted your life? What questions do you have about meditation? What are some challenges you encounter when you try to meditate? Have you tried meditation to help manage a health issue? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. We'll return after a check of the news here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. We're learning about how meditation can help in our everyday life, sharpening our focus, improving our relationships, relieving some stress. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Neuroscientist Richard Davidson stays with us. His new book is titled Altered Traits, Science reveals how meditation changes your mind, brain, and body. He reviewed thousands of academic studies on meditation and parsed out the hype from the legitimate scientific findings. You can join in the discussion at 800-642-1234. Do you set aside time for meditation? How long, how often, and why? Wondering how to get started? Join in and ask at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones with Steve joining us in Madison. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So thank you for taking the phone call. I have a quick question to Dr. Richardson, and thank you for doing all this research on this important subject. Some of the studies have, you know, or actually most of the studies are just observational studies looking into people who actually practice. I haven't seen a lot of research in which it, you know, titled the robust scientific method in which, you know, a positive effect of meditation is studied in a better way. So how can we be sure that a scientist wouldn't do a research that looks into the positive effect that he or she likes to see? And thank you.
Yeah, Richard, go ahead.
Well, thank you for that important question. There are lots of there's lots of variation in the quality of scientific research done on meditation, just as there's variation in scientific research in any area. The scientific method is one where we try to make our biases explicit if they are there, or eliminate them if we can. And of course, the hallmark of scientific research is replication. And we really don't take findings too seriously until and unless they're replicated. So your comment about observational studies is not quite true. There are really good, robust, randomized controlled trials where participants are randomly assigned to a meditation condition or a control condition and then followed over time to examine the impact. And this is a much more rigorous way of examining the impact. And there are some studies that find very little effect on certain kinds of measures, but there are effects on other measures that have been reported. And so this is really what we do in the book Altered Traits, is we distill all of the scientific findings. And in fact, one of the conclusions that we come to is a conclusion that you're alluding to, which is that quite a lot of scientific research on meditation is not a very high quality. And what we did in the book is we specifically paid attention to those studies that judged to be of much better quality. And those studies do indicate that there is indeed benefit. Now, your question about bias, certainly I meditate. I believe both from my own personal experience and from scientific research that it's valuable, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be studying it. It would be like telling a cardiologist who studies the benefits of physical exercise on the heart that he or she themselves should not do physical exercise as long as they're engaged in scientific research on the question. I think that's ridiculous, and there are checks and balances in the scientific process that enable us to do this in a way that still maintains the highest levels of integrity and rigor.
Steve, thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Tim now, who joins us from Green Bay. Hi, Tim.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is there anything that I could suggest to my mom and have her do maybe like some type of exercise? She has some pretty bad dementia happening right now.
Yeah, great question. There is a little bit of scientific research looking at the impact of meditation on disorders of aging, including dementia, and it's a very difficult and challenging situation. And certainly it's not going to hurt to try, but there's also not a whole lot of evidence to suggest that in someone who is already showing signs of dementia that it will have much impact. Where it does seem to play an important role is looking at individuals who may be at risk for dementia, and in minimizing the severity and perhaps delaying the onset. But again, this is an area that is just now being intensively studied scientifically, and so there's not that much that we can say based on hard-nosed science.
Tim, thanks so much for calling in with that question. Richard, what about people on the autism spectrum? Can someone with autism benefit from a meditation practice?
Again, this is an area where the scientific research is just beginning. There's a little bit of evidence to suggest that it may be beneficial, but certainly not a lot. Again, I would say that unlike a drug, there are relatively few side effects, negative side effects of trying. And so I think it's worth exploring, particularly if it's being being done by someone who is both experienced with meditation and also has a lot of knowledge about the disorder in question.
Let's go to Paul, who joins us from Madison. Hi, Paul. Go ahead with your question.
The question I have you studied meditation or used it with people that have depression?
Yes, there is quite a bit of research that's been done on meditation and depression. And there has been an important development in research in this area, which is the development of a hybrid intervention that's called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And it's really bringing mindfulness meditation together with one of the most empirically well-validated psychological treatments for depression, and that is cognitive therapy. And there's a lot of research on mindfulness-based cognitive therapy in clearly showing its efficacy, and it's particularly valuable in minimizing the likelihood of depressive relapse. Depression is a recurring illness. If someone has an episode of major depression, they are likely to have another one. And so mindfulness-based cognitive therapy can be particularly helpful in minimizing the likelihood and or decreasing the severity of a subsequent relapse.
So can meditation work in tandem with perhaps prescription medication for depression?
Yes, certainly. And this is something also that can and in many cases I think should be explored. But there's very little scientific research that has directly addressed the combination of meditation and medication.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for calling in. We're with Richard Davidson here. His book is Altered Traits: Science Reveals How Meditation Changes Your Mind, Brain, and Body. Richard, how are athletes and sports teams using meditation today?
It's becoming increasingly popular among athletes. In fact, our center is now working with the UW Department of Athletics here in Madison. We also just very recently completed a pilot study with retired NFL players, retired players who were playing in the National Football League, who first of all, have been subjected to brain trauma, and also are suffering in other ways as a consequence of their athletic career. And so I think that it could play an enormously valuable role, and it really is just beginning to be explored scientifically. But we do know that many athletic teams, both at the collegiate level and at the professional level, are using meditation and have found it to be valuable.
Well, going back to this statistic of the 47% of the time our brain isn't in the present, what do we know about meditation being used and picked up in the corporate world, in the corner offices with CEOs?
There's a huge uptake in this area. Some of the largest most valuable corporations in the world are expressing tremendous interest in this and have established programs for their employees to learn meditation. And it's not just in the tech industry, like at places like Google and Apple and Facebook, but also in corporations right here in the Midwest. General Mills, for example, is one corporation where this has been seriously incorporated. PricewaterhouseCoopers, another. There is a huge interest, and there's reason to believe that these practices can help with focus, can also help improve interpersonal interactions, teamwork. I think that there's a general recognition that if employees show up at work and are more fully present, are happier, and have higher levels of well-being, it's a double win. It's a win for the employees, and it's a win for the organization.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Richard Davidson is the William James and Vilas Research Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry at UW-Madison, where he directs a brain lab and founded the Center for Healthy Minds. He co-wrote the new book, Altered Traits: Science Reveals How Meditation Changes Your Mind, Brain, and Body. This hour of the morning show was produced by Naeja Ellison. Ideas Network Director Cheryl Gasser provided on-air production, with Dave Potraz running technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're with us here on the Ideas Network.